You're listening to Peach Pit TV.
Depth of Field is made possible by the fine folks at Peach Pit Press, publishers of inspiration, creativity, and technique. With best-selling titles like Visual Poetry by Chris Orwig, Within the Frame by David Duchemin, and The Hot Shoe Diaries by Joe McNally, Peach Pit Press books and videos for today's photographers and Photoshop users. Welcome to Depth of Field. I'm Matt Brandon, and today I have a photographer I've been trying to get on this show for some time, and the guy travels too much, and so I just haven't been able to get him, and that is Mitchell Koneshkovich. Did I say your name right?
Yeah, that's very close, Matt. I think it's almost perfect. It's almost perfect. Only the emphasis is a little wrong, but other than that, it's perfect.
All right, let me try the emphasis again. Koneshkovich. Koneshkovich.
No, it's Koneshkovich, but it's okay.
Koneshkovich. Koneshkovich.
Yeah.
Koneshkovich. All right. Anyway, how about just Mitch or Mitchell? How about that?
Yeah, either one will do.
Anyway, I'm talking with that man, that photographer, who you probably have seen his work out on the web. Amazing use of light, amazing travel documentary photographer. He's been published in the British Geographic Society magazine and Getty Images. He shoots for Getty, so Getty's got his stuff everywhere, from MTV to billboards. So the guy has got an eye like I haven't seen in a long time. And I've actually known Mitch for a long time, but haven't had a chance to sit down and chat like this. So I'm looking forward to it. So welcome, Mitch, to Depth of Field.
Thanks, Matt.
So we first met back through online forum, same when I met with David Duchemin, and that was through the Travel Photographers Network. That was a short-lived relationship, but there you go. That's where we started.
It wasn't that short-lived. We hung out there for a while, I think. The site lasted for a couple of years.
Well, actually, you know, the site's still going on.
Yeah, that's right.
I think a lot of new photographers got a start there, and I think it's a great little site. So, but Mitch, you are really known for a lot of your travel and documentary stuff, and I have always found it stunning. I think it's always been inspiring and motivational to read it. Of course, you can find it on your blog, which is...
go to mitchellkphotos.com/blog.
There you go.
Yeah.
And of course, it'll be on the link with this as well. Tell me a little bit of your history here. How did you get started? And you moved to Australia from... Eastern Europe?
Yeah, the story is that I was born in a country which is called Belarus. When I was born, it was still part of the USSR. So the time that I moved was when my parents decided to move after the breakdown of the Soviet Union, as many people kind of at that stage felt that they were sort of seeing the end of the world in the early 90s. As soon as they got a chance, you know, as soon as this so-called Iron Curtain went down, they just, you know, wanted to get the heck out of there and start a new life, hopefully a better life in another country. So Australia was one of the places where they could go, and that my, you know, because my father, he's an IT person, he's a programmer, there was a real need for people like that at that time, and so he just left, and I was about 10, and yeah, the whole family moved here, and since then I've been kind of living here, but I guess in the last few years I've not really been living in any one particular place. But I think that, I suppose, both countries have had an impact on me, because, you know, wherever you're born and wherever you spend your childhood years, it'll always kind of stay with you, and it'll form your personality in a way. But at the same time, the country which you know, where you get your education, where you have your teenage years and all that sort of stuff, that's also definitely going to have an impact on your life. So, yeah, that's the background on where I'm from, I guess. And I guess the whole love for travel probably began because of our visits back there, you know, back to the motherland, so to say. We would, because it's such a long way away from Australia, we would stop in places, you know, on our way there, and that's when I really got a taste for traveling and fell in love with it. And I guess so did my parents.
They still do a lot of traveling, your parents?
Well, they're traveling right now. After I told them how much I loved Portugal and Spain, which is sort of where I had my last sort of real trip, they were so keen to go that they actually just left there.
Yeah. Well, I remember some of your first work that I can recall. It was actually of Belarus, and you did some really wonderful stuff there using a reflector and stuff. And I remember some of the people just were making comments like, "How did you get that kind of light and everything?" And you were just using a reflector. That was quite a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe that would have been about 2006. That would have been on one of my trips where I was visiting my future wife over there. And yeah, I got to play around with the reflector. I just kind of learned that this thing exists, and that's one of the first trips where I got to use it.
And so wait a minute. You were visiting your future wife. Did you meet her on a trip, or was this an
Yeah,
arranged
I met
marriage that your folks did?
her. No, not quite arranged. No. What happened was, during one of these family visits, because I like to visit the family, my cousins, my aunties, my grandmother, and back then my grandfather was around as well. I really, loved visiting them as whenever I got the chance. So this was during one of those visits. But back then I was into documentary films. What I planned was to film Belarus in the winter because it's stunning, it's beautiful in the winter. If there's snow, if there isn't any snow, it's one of the most depressing places that you can be. So at that time, there was no snow, and that was the key for why I ended up on this Belarusian film shoot. And I hung out there much longer than I was supposed to. I was supposed to just spend a few days seeing, how they worked, just out of curiosity. And then I kind of asked if I could tag along a little longer because I had nothing to film because there was no snow. And so that's how I met my wife. She was part of the team on this film. And yeah, we kind of met there. And I said, "Hey, do you want to join me in one of my trips, maybe to India one day?" Thinking that, no one will really be crazy enough to go all the way from Belarus to India. But she agreed. And yeah, the rest is kind of progressed quite quickly. And yeah, that's it.
History, as they say, huh?
Yeah, I guess it's history still being written. But yeah, she's been probably the one person that's really kept me, completely sane, grounded, and probably a big reason why I have, progressed as far as I have. I think were it not for her, I would probably be much more distracted in my journeys, and probably would have gone off the rails somewhere along the way.
I'm sure she appreciates that respect that you give her. And I think, hey, let me ask you, how many countries have you visited so far? Have you kept count?
No, I don't know. I think it's really not that many at all. But yeah, I guess it's kind of it's a growing list.
But you spend a lot of time in each one, though. But I think the thing that distinguishes you is you don't just go in and spend a week at some place. You'll spend what, a month or longer at a place like this?
Yeah, I think that if it's a new country that I'm traveling to, I think at least, 2, 3 months, something like that. I think that kind of gives you, I suppose that only really begins to give you a taste for the country, the culture, the people, and also depends on how big the country is. Somewhere like India, 3 months is sort of like a good little introduction, but you don't even really begin to understand much during that period of time, unless you may be staying in one particular area for that amount of time. So yeah, I think that at least, with the approach that I have, I do like to travel longer to really try and at least begin to understand things. I don't pretend that I can really understand a culture, or a country or a people in 3 months, but at least I try, I give it a go.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I appreciate the honesty there because I think there's a lot of people out there that they go to some place for a few days and they think they have it wired. And the reality is you can live in a place for years and not ever have a clue. Even if you submerge yourself in the culture, there's such subtleties in these cultures that are not your own that people are learning after a lifetime. And so to admit that, I think informs your images a lot better and allows for for images that aren't even dogmatic, you know. I think that oftentimes photographers can come back with images that you might describe as dogmatic, in that they show one side of a culture that's unfair to the culture.
Yeah, I suppose that can be said, yeah. I mean, you would know much better than me yourself, because you spent, 13 years in Kashmir, and I'm sure that there are certain things that you might still be surprised by, you know, or you were surprised by towards your final days there.
Yeah,
so, yeah, that's definitely the case, and I think it does affect your photography, certainly, without a doubt.
How would you describe your point of view or your angle of travel photography? Do you call yourself a travel photographer, or what do you?
I suppose, well, you know, if we're going to have these pigeonholes and that sort of stuff, I suppose, yeah, I'm travel documentary, cultural photographer, something along those lines. But I guess travel is such a broad term, really, you know, that it covers so much that I think it is actually quite appropriate, because I'm interested in so many things. You know, I am mostly interested in human stories, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to be swayed to shoot some beautiful mountain landscape or something like that. So I suppose travel is, if you were to categorize, I suppose that's a kind of a good way to categorize it, even though some people may have a problem with that whole term travel photographer in general, but you know, that's a whole different story.
Right. Yeah. But how, what defines your images over someone else's? How would you distinguish your stuff?
How would I distinguish it? I think, I'm very interested in people. I'm very interested to go a little bit beyond the surface. You know, if I'm traveling, especially lately, if I'm traveling in India, for instance, if I see a man in a turban or, you know, some colorful scene, I'm not necessarily even going to take the camera out to photograph that. I'm trying to find what else is there to the scene, you know. So I suppose that if you were to say what sort of distinguishes my images, I would like to think that it's a certain level of depth, a certain level of understanding, perhaps, again, you know, or at least that I am showing that I'm trying to understand something, you know, whatever I'm photographing. So I think that if there was anything, I suppose that would be it, that I'm just trying to create images with a certain amount of depth, rather than just, you know, I want them to be exotic on one level, but I want them to have a story, you know, that is beyond exotic on another level. So perhaps maybe, you know, multi-layered in that sense at the same time, simple and complex at the same time. I suppose that would be the ultimate aim of what I would want to do. I don't think I'm quite, you know, there yet, but I suppose I'm getting there with some images.
Do you feel like you have a definable or a describable method that you use to enter into a culture that is foreign to you? Are there certain things that you could describe that you find yourself doing to gain access to a culture?
Yeah, I think you can't really say that there's one method, because, you know, every situation is so different. Mm-hmm. You know, what will work in Asia is certainly not going to work in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. So I suppose if you really break it down to what's most essential, is that I just try to give people respect. I try to show genuine interest, which is, you know, I have genuine interest in those people if I'm there to photograph them and their culture. So, but I don't think that there's really a method as such, because that would really kind of be, you know, making the whole thing very formulaic.
Yeah, contrived.
Yeah, you know, like, and it's just not going to work. You know, people, you know, in Southeast Asia, they'll be sort of happy just to have you around just because you're a foreigner, and they'll open up to you just because you're curious in what they're doing. It's kind of, they feel quite often flattered that this person who's obviously from far away is taking a liking in something that's so everyday to them. But, you know, in somewhere like, again, my home country of Belarus, where I pass for just a regular person, just me showing interest isn't going to work. There has to be something else. It becomes a much more complex thing, you know, and so there it's almost like I have to, in order to get into a culture, I have to kind of convince them that what I want to do, which is photograph them, is going to be good for both me and them.
So you have to develop some sort of a trust bond there. They have to be able to trust you, that you're not going to portray them as some clown or something.
Yeah, I think that, again, the clown thing is probably, yeah, some of them might think that, but others, again, there are so many details, so many intricacies in different cultures and countries. For example, in Belarus, there's quite a big fear of government cracking down on certain things. So a lot of the time people have this paranoia that if you're photographing them, they've done something bad. Once I would just be driving around my, beaten up car around there, and then whenever I'd see something interesting, I'd kind of stop and quickly chat to the people, and if there was a particular fleeting moment, I'd ask right there and then if I can take their photograph. But during one instance, I saw this amazing scene of a family on a horse carriage, and I stopped the car, got out, and I said, I'm doing a photo story on the Belarusian countryside. Can I take your photograph? And they said, don't take a photograph of us. We're good people. We haven't done anything bad. So, there's a really different reactions everywhere. I would have never have thought that I would get that reaction. I could have maybe imagined that they'd say, get out of here. We've got no time for it. But to say something like that, and then they whipped the horse and just quickly got the heck out of there. So, that's kind of one example of how things can go. But on the other hand, I could have used the same line with a person who had a sort of a different approach and a different mindset, and we could sort of even become friends from that. I would have a bit of a talk. I might have taken a few images, and then it could have developed into a friendship, which is what happened a few times actually while I was over there shooting.
So did you get the picture eventually of the, did you convince them?
Oh, not of those people. No, well,
No.
their horse was too fast for me to run after it. That was,
So when someone says, and you say, "Hey, may I take a picture," or something like this, and they say no, you just respect that and walk away, or do you try to convince them, and you work with them a little bit, or what do you do?
yeah. Again, I think this really depends on one's understanding, or the level of understanding of a culture, that sometimes you have to know when a no really means I'm shy,
Exactly.
or when a no really means no. Because again, in Asia, a lot of young children or girls or even women, they may be very shy. They're gonna put their hands over their face, laugh, and say no, but really they don't really mean no. It's just that they're extremely shy. In those cases, you just kind of have to know when the boundary is. If you see that smile change to a worried look, then it's a definite no, and it's better not to push. But if it's just all laughter and the person eventually opens up, then obviously that was just the person being shy.
Right. One of the things in Kashmir that you probably found out this is that oftentimes you have to ask something like three times. That seems to be the magic number before you'll get a positive response. So someone will say, "Would you like a cup of tea?" And they'll say, "Oh, no. Oh, please have a cup of tea." No. Oh, please. Oh, okay, I'll have a cup of tea." They really wanted a cup of tea. Culturally, you put on this. I don't know if it's a really an air of humility, but there is a sense of humility that is cultural, and they put that on, and it takes asking of almost, usually it's around three times, no set rule. I mean, they don't learn this in school. So that's when sometimes you're out in the woods or something, and there's a shepherd comes up and says, "I take your picture." "Oh, no. Oh, please. No. Just one pic." "Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead and do it."
Yeah.
It really feels counterintuitive in a sense, because you think they've told me no twice. Doesn't that mean no? But
Yeah, but again, I think it really depends. See, because you understand that culture, you have a certain
exactly
level of understanding. And
right.
if I'm doing the same thing, for example, I was shooting in Israel at the Wailing Wall, and there a no means a no from one time. So
Yeah.
one no should be enough to understand, because it's a totally different situation.
Yeah.
And I think that, although I didn't understand the culture at the time that I was there, I quickly understood, because again, from people's body language, from their expressions,
Right.
you can see that they weren't particularly happy with that. And I don't really think that any photograph is worth really pissing someone off for,
right.
So much that you kind of leave a stale taste in their mouth and yours.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But, you know, one of the biggest things that, and I'm sure you get this asked all the time, is how do you approach people? How do you have the nerve to just walk up to people and to photograph them? How do you work through the, I don't know, maybe it's an intimidation factor or something in your own spirit that keeps you from going up to someone, especially maybe a culture that's very different than yours. How do you do that?
I think I've kind of learned to do it over time. You know, I wasn't so good at doing it in the beginning. Uh-huh. I was also quite shy. And I think actually that the trip to India really kind of changed me in a way, because all the time before I was in India, I would have to kind of ask people, or I felt like I was maybe intruding by taking a photograph. And then on my first day around Delhi, I started walking around these back streets and people are saying, come and take my picture, you know, come and take our photograph. They see the camera around my neck and everyone is inviting me to take their pictures and to have tea. And so I thought, oh my God, you know, that these guys actually, I don't even have to ask anybody. They're all asking me to take their photographs. So that kind of really helped me grow my confidence quite a bit, you know. And after the confidence grew, I could also approach people that, you know, I could approach them by myself. I could, I didn't have to wait for them to ask me. I just kind of, it grew from there. Mm-hmm. And then as you have more and more experiences, you sort of learn how to set up yourself for success rather than failure. And the more success you have, obviously, as with anything in life, the more confident you become, the more your confidence grows. And then in the end, it kind of, again, brings more success, because, you know, you're confident in your ways and you really know what to say. And it really comes through to that person who you want to photograph. And quite often, because of that, they'll also be more willing to be a part of your image. If you're acting a certain way, if you don't have that confidence about you, if you don't have that vibe, then quite often people might also be skeptical of your motives. You know, they might not think that perhaps your motives are so pure, or, you know, if you're kind of acting all shy and undecisive, they might think, what does this guy really want from me? But I think, again, if you have that confidence, if you know exactly what you want and you can communicate it to the people, then the worst thing that you've got, you know, that might happen is them just saying, no, sorry, you can't do it. And that's it.
Right. And I think that's a key thing there, is that that's the worst that can happen generally. I mean, I suppose there's the odd person that turn out pull out a gun and shoot you, but
well, no, I think if you ask that person first, then probably they're not going to shoot you. That the only times when it might happen is that when you kind of try to sneak a picture in,
right.
You know, in those situations, again, I think it comes with time when you know when you can try to sneak a picture in and when you can't, because obviously we might not want to only take those, you know, photographs where people are looking at you or are aware of you.
Yeah,
we might just want to capture a fleeting moment, but you also kind of have to have a feel for when you should be able to try that and when you shouldn't.
Yeah, let's don't use the word sneak though, because I don't think it's really sneaking. I think what you're doing is taking a candid shot, someone who is camera unaware, if you will. I look through your work and I find the vast majority of your shots, the people are, they don't come off as camera aware. They could very well be aware that you're standing there taking a picture of them, but it doesn't come off that way. You have, I would say, a 4-to-5-to-1 ratio of where people are going about doing their work, or they're looking out a window, or they're doing something.
Yeah.
And you've been able to catch that moment in time, as opposed to the person then turns and stares at you and you take their picture, which both are good, but
yeah,
they communicate two different things. And
yeah, I think I've been consciously trying to take, you know, more of those kinds of images recently. And it doesn't, I guess with photography, things, you know, the behind the scenes are not necessarily what might come through the image. The
right.
People are certainly aware of me or aware of my presence in the beginning. But in a lot of those cases, I've become friends with a person. I've spent so much time that they no longer care about me pointing the camera. And in that sense, I guess they kind of, it's not that they're unaware of the camera, it's that they forget about its presence and just kind of carrying on about their own thing. And I guess that's where, again, investing time into the photographic project really pays off, because you can get those kinds of images. And you, like you say, it doesn't mean that the images where people are looking at you directly and that there's that, well, there's that obvious awareness, doesn't mean that those images are bad, but that's just kind of, I felt like that's what I started off shooting, and I kind of like to mix things up a little bit.
One of the things I've always liked about you, Mitch, is that you're very outspoken. I remember a review that you gave me years ago on the Travel Photography Network, and you basically said something along the lines, and I don't remember word for word, but it was something along the lines of, "Yeah, it's okay," and you know, and, it, okay. And I was really, really heartbroken. You know, who's this guy think he is? It's okay. That's a great image, you know. And you were like, "Yeah, you've had a lot better work, but it's okay." But then you went on to say why. What do you think, using that candid sense of yours that I've always appreciated, what do you think is lacking in today's travel and documentary photography that you're seeing out?
Matt, you're speaking to me as if I'm, you know, 60 years old and I'm some kind of wise guru or something like that. I
well, you know, I don't think you're obviously not 60 years old. You're a young chap, but I think your work is very mature.
Thanks.
And that's why I'm speaking to you that way.
Yeah, it's a hard question, because I don't really know if I'm really in a position to answer it. You know, ultimately, who am I to say? But
you got opinions. Come on, I know.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah, if you're purely asking for my opinion, then I guess
that's what I'm asking.
Yeah,
for.
I don't know. I think it would have to be that lack of spending time, the lack of depth. I think it's a problem with the whole world in general, that we want quick answers, quick, you know, fast food, everything at the tip of your fingers within seconds. I suppose that also translates to photography for some people. So somebody goes to India, thinks, wow, this is photographer's paradise. They take these images, which I've seen a million times before, and then, you know, but I did that too in the beginning. So I guess right. that's a normal kind of thing. But I suppose some people never progress, they never go past that, and others kind of try to find if there is anything else. And I really salute those people who do want to look for, you know, who do want to dig a little bit beyond what's obvious, beyond the surface. And I think that, yeah, a lot of the stuff, it's just not that great, because the person hasn't really invested time, hasn't spoken to the person that they're photographing, hasn't bothered to learn anything. You know, I guess that's what would be wrong with, or what would be bad about travel photography in some cases.
Well, let me add to that for a second, because one of the things that I read a blog post on yours blog one time that I just was hysterical. You were basically saying, okay, this is to all the people that say, I want to get into the travel photography business, and how do I do it? And they write you all the time, and you wrote back and did this open letter to everyone.
Right, right.
You basically told them, you know, if you shoot crap, then just quit. I mean, you know, what's the point?
No. I didn't quite say it like that. I think you kind of misinterpreted it, Matt. what I said was that, you know, if you've only shot a little bit of stuff and it's crap, then it's kind of too early for me to say anything to them, you know, because a lot of the time, people, again, it comes back to wanting things so quickly, wanting things without really putting in the work. And so a lot of the people, they've gone for one trip and they say, how can I make a living out of this? Well, I don't know if after one trip you even know if you can make a living out of it. You know, after 4 years, I didn't know if I can make a living out of it. And some people think that one trip is enough. That kind of naivety, I think, is actually good in a way, because, again, that's in a sense how I was. And that's why I don't tell them that this stuff is crap, quit, because my stuff was crap in the beginning, but it was just not enough to make any conclusions. And I think that if somebody actually wants to make a living out of travel photography, the main thing is to make a body of work that you're proud of, that is really of a high level, and only then you should start about, you know, thinking how you can get money with it, not trying to skip all these steps, because what are you going to make a living with 20 images that you came back from Southeast Asia on your trip that you did when quitting your job or something like that? You know, I think that's the key thing, that people try to go fast too quick and they just think that none of that other stuff in between is important.
What do you think the hardest part of being a travel photographer is? The travel, the shooting, or the behind the scenes post-processing and categorizing it and cataloging it and uploading it to your you know, all the Lightroom work and all that stuff?
I think that the shooting is never really hard. You know, if you're a real kind of adventurous spirit and a traveler at heart and a photographer at heart, then the shooting can never really be hard. You know, that's usually the part that most of us enjoy. The traveling depends how you're traveling. Sometimes it's physically hard. Like when I travel on a motorcycle, it's physically hard, but it's so enjoyable in different ways that ultimately it's hard, but it's amazing.
Yeah.
The plane travel I hate because I have to fly so long from Australia. You know, but so that's still not so hard. I think, the post-processing and all that sort of stuff, for somebody moved away from film partly because I hated spending so much time editing, that part is kind of probably what I find to be the most challenging thing, you know, because I don't want to be spending time on the computer for 11 hours a day, but sometimes that's what you got to do. If you come back from a trip, you've got thousands of images, you have to do that, unless you can afford to get someone else to post-process your images. But then, in a sense, it's not really your work anyway. So, yeah.
It is. I think for me, that's probably the thing that people don't count on the most when these people say, well, we want to be travel photographers. And the only thing they think about is out shooting the image. And then they think all of a sudden it comes out looking great. I know of one humanitarian photographer, Carl Grobel. He shoots everything in JPEG and essentially delivers it to this client in a raw JPEG, if you can use those terms that way.
Yeah.
There's very few other photographers I know that can pull that off. And I think that the amount of time spent in Lightroom and working on the images and, you know, working on one image to put it up on a travel photography network is enjoyable. Working on 500 images is work.
Yeah, it gets tiresome, and yeah, it's rewarding in its own way. But again, when like you say, you're just working on one particular image that you really kind of love, but it depends as well where you're delivering those images. When I do stuff, when I edit some of the images for Getty, they might not all be my favorite images. I might not enjoy working in all of those images, but yeah, again, that's work, because that has to go up and they have to be post-processed. They have to be to the specifications and everything like that. And there's no way around it. You've got to put in the work.
How do you stay on your game? How do you keep improving your work? What do you do to sharpen your skills?
I don't know. I think in some way I'm really very self-motivated. I think it comes with being, an immigrant child in a sense, because my parents, they left former USSR for a better life. And there's kind of this competitive drive that's built into you already, that you can't fail. You have to keep striving, you know, to be better, to do better work, to have a better life, and so on. So I think part of it is that. And then when you combine it with the fact that I look at quite a lot of work of photographers out there, and you just see, damn, you know, that stuff is so good. What the hell am I doing? I'm just wasting my time. Sometimes you get that.
That's what happens when I look at your work.
Well, come on. But
it's true. I mean, your work is so stunning. You know, people say, look at these photographers and get inspired. I look at some of these guys and get totally depressed, and you're one of them. I look at your stuff and I think, oh, crap, I'm never going to be able to shoot like that.
I don't know whether to thank you or to say what, Matt, but it's a rather unusual thing to say. I guess I don't get depressed, but I kind of think that I got to, you know, raise my game. I got to do something meaningful. I have to do something good, powerful. It kind of inspires me to grow, even though in between, I think I'm just kind of doing crap in between that. But ultimately, I like to turn it into a positive and to let that be a stepping stone for me to get somewhere higher.
So tell me about some of your techniques that you're doing. You have a couple of ebooks out. One of them that I really enjoyed is one on lighting and some off-camera lighting. Can you, I know this is essentially just an audio program, but not essentially, it is just an audio program. So maybe you can give some description on how you go about using off-camera flash in the field in places, because that's something that I think a lot of travel photographers, they tend to find themselves being available light and that's it. And you actually use quite a bit of assisted lighting.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I'm kind of moving more and more away from that during this period of my life. But yeah, it's something that I did use quite a lot. And it's really not that difficult because with the equipment today, you know, you just get the standard. I use a Canon, so I have a 580 EX2 or whatever the name of the flash is. I got some of those free little gels that I think they're no longer free on BH Photo Video, but before they used to send you these free samples, and I've still got a few of them. And I just started experimenting. Also, I used a softbox that was portable and that could fold into my wife's purse. So that was very convenient. And yeah, really then when you have another person with you, it becomes very easy. If you don't, then you can use a little tripod. Right. You can get quite small tripods that will work with that. So, I mean.
But it still takes a lot of time. This is not one of these grab the moment type of an image. This is okay, I'm sitting in this hut. How can I shoot this picture of this guy making soup over this wood stove? And so this is not a spur of the moment type of thing. You've planned these things out.
Yeah, I do, and I think that it's a real misconception a lot of the time on the part of people who are perhaps not so aware of how this kind of photography works, but a lot of the images they're kind of already in my mind a long time before I take them. It's again, it comes from spending the time in a certain place. It comes from observing. It comes from then knowing really what to expect from a particular scene. And in that case, I think I know what image you're talking about. It's probably a photograph of these sulfur miners inside a small hut. You know, eating their breakfast, and back then I didn't have I think Canon 5D Mark II wasn't out back then, and so you could only really push the 5D Mark I to about 1600 ISO without having the image basically be unusable. So I thought, okay, how do I make this picture usable and still capture the ambience and still, you know, tell this part of the story? And the flash, it seemed like quite a reasonable choice of a tool to help me tell that story. And yeah, basically that's how it comes about. It's first you familiarize yourself with the scene, with what's happening, then you think of what you actually want to say, and then you try to solve the problem how you want to tell it. How can you tell it in this situation? You think of the technical limitations, and again in that case that the technical limitation was that the camera couldn't go past 1600 ISO. I needed to bring down the ISO and to give me a little bit more light, as you mentioned, to assist the light which was already there. So yeah, that's how the idea came about. And in that case, I actually put it on a little tripod in the corner and fired it off, you know, a few shots, and that was that.
Would you say the gel you use the most would be the sort of orange yellowish, what they call a CTO?
Yeah, the ones that they had in this sample kit, there's like about 20 shades of orange, so it's almost any one of those 20 shades, and then there's like 20 shades of another orange. So yeah,
it just really reproduces that candle, that fire reflective
very nice
feel.
Yeah, and I think if I'm trying to emulate a daylight, then it's I'd be using a very 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 light orange, almost kind of on the border of transparent, but just a slight tinge. So that's the one that I like to use if I'm trying to emulate daylight.
All right. So, but you said you're trying to get away from that now. Why is that?
It's not so much that I'm trying to get away. It's that I'm kind of just trying to get the most out of natural light. And in fact, the next book will be all about natural light, just to put that in there. But okay. Yeah, I think we can do so much with natural light. And I'm really trying to simplify my life all the time, you know, to really have less stuff with me. So even though the softbox is not so big, the flash, if you put it in the bag, it's still kind of makes the bag a little bit heavier. And also, if you have a
sound. You're not seriously going to leave your flash at home, are you?
Oh, yeah. Next trip, I'm leaving my flash at home.
Really?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you're just going to go out with your cameras and then a few lenses and what, a reflector? Or what are you using now?
No, I'm not going to take a reflector. I'll just use the light that's there, natural light. I think that with natural light, you can do so much. And with the cameras that are out there today, with the low light capabilities, it's incredible what you can do. More so Nikon, which is why I've kind of been, you know, thinking of getting those cameras, because they're just so stunning in low light. But
I'm more and more Canon guys are switching over to Nikon. It's interesting.
I just don't want that extra thing in my bag, you know, and if I can shoot with a Nikon, if I can get the results that I want, then great. You know, I think that a lot of the times these technical sort of boundaries, they can be pretty frustrating, you know. And if you can take away one of these limitations, then it's an awesome thing.
Yeah. And the apparently the ISO on some of these new Nikon cameras it's almost non-existent, you know, grain and things like that. So it's pretty stinking impressive.
Yeah.
It allows for a lot.
I played around with this photographer's Nikon about a year ago. I think, I don't know, it was one of the upper range models. And I think I shot in 12,000 something ISO, and it was quite stunning. It was amazing. You know, when I was struggling with my camera at 2,500 or whatever it was, he could shoot on 12,000. So I thought, geez, this is something. Yeah.
Not just that. Have you ever played with the what Canon? I don't know what Nikon calls it on theirs, but the AI servo for when someone's moving at you and you're shooting. Mm-hmm. The D3X is. We were playing with that on the workshop I was at. Had the Canon shooting and then had someone playing with the D3X, and this person was literally dancing around in this low light room.
Right.
And out of 20 frames, I think only one frame on the Nikon was out of focus.
Wow.
And it was almost the other way around with the Canon. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I guess that's just the way that things are, you know, and technology is always improving, and it's kind of good to keep your eyes on that, but at the same time, not to get too distracted with it, because, you know, ultimately it's not in every situation that you can take advantage of these amazing features.
That's right. So tell me about your books. Right now you have two or three ebooks. How many do you have?
No, I think it's more. I don't even remember now. I think there's like five, something like that. Yeah. Oh, five or six.
Okay.
I think there might be six.
But are they all available on your website? Or they? I know you did one with Craft and Vision.
Yeah, they're a bit all over the place, but you can certainly get links to them from my website. Yeah, you can. Some of them are being distributed through Digital Photography School, DPS. One through Craft and Vision, and two I kind of just published on my own quite a while ago, and you can get them from my website as well.
All right. And what are they, what's the topics on these?
One is on travel photography, so a very general topic, but kind of, I think it's a good introduction, and maybe even a little beyond introduction, just kind of demystifying what it's like to take those kinds of images, you know, which people might think that I might never be able to take photographs like that. I kind of try to take them behind the scenes of how you can take photographs like that. Another one, you know, as you mentioned, is on light. That's one that I published myself. The very first one that I did is on post-processing, which probably needs to be updated at some stage, but I think that the basic philosophy behind it will remain the same as long as Lightroom doesn't completely change their interface or, you know, whatever their philosophy for post-processing is. And the one with David is the print and process on my travel to Indonesia. And I think the one that I think is a little bit unusual that I haven't seen anyone write anything on that topic is it's on color. It's actually on using how to approach and how to use color in your photography. And that's also with Digital Photography School.
So then what's the future hold for you? What's happening in the days and months ahead?
I really think it's been a pretty hard question lately because there are all these, you know, potential things that might happen, might not happen. So yeah, it's kind of hard to tell. I try to take it maybe not to plan anything further than 2 months ahead because you never know what could come up. There are certain opportunities that might come up, and if they truly materialize, then I'll be traveling for quite some time longer. If not, then I'll probably have a few more sort of shorter trips. Africa is somewhere that I've been really wanting to go for a long time, but I kind of get stuck in all these countries because I fall in love with every one of them in a different way. So I tend to stay for really a long time. But yeah, I'd really love to visit Ethiopia. So who knows, maybe I'll end up there in the not distant future.
I keep trying to get to Africa too. In fact, I was supposed to have a trip scheduled for Ethiopia as well. This quarter, but it looks like that's fallen through. Every time I try to get to Africa, things don't work out. So I'm with you right there. I feel your pain. Hey, do you ever do any workshops?
It's something that I wanted to do initially, but I think that, I don't know if I'm so comfortable teaching workshops at this stage, and they just have to be done so carefully, you know, because I like to teach people to have a very personal approach when they're photographing other people. And in a workshop, it's just so difficult to manage. I mean, I have no idea how you do it. And I think I'm just, I haven't figured a way in which I could manage more than, let's say, two people on a workshop. I had a private workshop once and it was fantastic. I had a good time, but I think it's not really financially viable. And I guess ultimately I still feel like I'm kind of young enough to just keep going, keep shooting for myself. And I feel that if I do go on a workshop, I'm not going to be shooting. I want it to be about those participants. And I essentially sort of miss out. I go somewhere wonderful and then I miss out on shooting. At least that's
true.
Yeah.
Well, no, I think that's true. And I think as a workshop leader myself, that's one of the things that you have to give up. I mean, it's your priority when you run a workshop is no longer taking photos.
Certainly,
it's teaching.
Yeah. And I think that the other difficult part is managing people, and the stuff that I like to do is get into some small tea shop or get into some hut, and I just can't imagine how I would handle that if I had more than, let's say, two people, or even if I had two people photographing. That kind of makes the situation potentially a very uncomfortable one, because the people in those places might not necessarily be used to being photographed by at all. And all of a sudden you've got two photographers and it becomes quite chaotic. And I don't necessarily think that I want to do that, but I suppose there are ways around that. I just think that I probably have other priorities at this particular moment. Not to say that I'm never going to do it, but not at this stage.
Let me throw out an idea. This is something that I and other workshop leaders of our ilk have struggled with. I mean, you've nailed the same thing. I mean, we all have that sort of duality to us, where on one hand we're used to working in a very intimate setting with people and strangers, and then the other time is we want to be able to teach people. But then we have a crowd with us. And so how do you do that? At the risk of plugging my own workshop here, one of the things that Gavin Goff and I are planning in February of 2012 is at Taipusam here in Malaysia.
Yeah, I read about here. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things we're going to do is actually have scheduled ahead of time. I will have met several families and have informed them of what we're going to be doing. And so we have developed a relationship with these families, and then we'll pair up photographers probably and have them introduced to the family. And then they essentially work all day for several days just with that family. Mm-hmm. And so it's not the whole group. It's just these two photographers developing a relationship with them over a period of several days in order to get a more of an insider's look into the Festival of Taipusam, something like that.
Yeah, it's a great idea, but it's kind of, there are all other issues that come up, and perhaps they like it this year, but how many years do they still want to go through it and so on? But certainly if it's something that might be a one-off or a two-off sort of thing, I think it would work great. And it's certainly a very nice, idea, very nice concept to have the people be aware that this is what will happen. And so it's not chaotic. So they kind of know what to expect and so on. But so many other issues come into it for me that I think it's such a difficult topic in general.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we wouldn't probably use the same people year after year, because you've got a festival of 100,000 people, and you have plenty to choose.
I suppose that's definitely in your favor.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's definitely a big plus. There are many people, yeah.
Okay.
Probably much more people than workshop participants that you could get in your whole lifetime, I guess. 100,000 people, yeah.
Hey, you know, you just got back from India. You were, in fact, you visited some friends of mine in Kashmir, didn't you?
Yeah, indeed I did. Very lovely folks they were. They saved me a lot of hassle because it's a war zone out there on the lake.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it quite literal in many ways as well.
It seems like it's quite pretty quiet lately, and it's really, things have really been picking up. But yeah, it's really one of these places which are not so easy because you have a lot of people trying to get money, and you're an obvious target for scams and all that sort of stuff. So I really appreciate that you hooked me up with Rashid. He was a wonderful guy, and yeah, really kind of made my life much easier, especially considering that I had very little time there as well.
Yeah, and I that is exactly right. The Kashmir, the Srinagar, the city of Srinagar in the Kashmir Valley is an intense place. It's a wonderful place to photograph, but it is, because they've had such a difficult time with tourism, because of the ongoing struggles there, the people are just so hungry. It's when a tourist shows up, they become a little bit like a feeding frenzy, and it just goes nuts. So I'm glad that worked out. So, but tell me more about your trip through the Himalayas, and you met up with some very special people, didn't you, along the way?
Yeah, well, I brought the most special person to be my wife with me on the trip. It was kind of I decided to do a little journey around the Indian Himalayas for my 30th birthday. Uh-huh. So I got two motorcycles, and I also invited my friend. He's an Indian from Gujarat, and he's probably the person that really made me fall in love with India. He's the guy that really kind of opened me up to an India which was, again, beyond this kind of, beyond the surface level, beyond the poverty, the begging, the scam artists that a lot of beginner travelers tend to encounter. Right. He kind of just gave me a totally different perspective on what's out there. And I met him about probably now 6 years ago or so. And since then, we've kept in touch. We've stayed friends. He joined me on some of the most intense and crazy journeys. We've gone through some of the toughest times together, but you know, we've remained friends through that. And I feel that a friend or any person that you're with while traveling, and if you can last, you know, let's say for more than a week of seeing each other every day, that's a friend that you'll probably keep for a lifetime. And that definitely turned out to be the case with him. So he was the one person that I really wanted to have with me on this journey, and it definitely wasn't an easy one either. I thought that I was maybe losing the taste for this difficult kind of travel, but in fact I enjoyed the trip more than ever before. But my wife was crying at stages because it was so physically intense, and so my friend was on the verge of crying, but at the end we made it through, and it was just a wonderful real bonding kind of experience, as cliched as that might sound. I mean, there was a lot of kind of difficulties in between, but that kind of those experiences show you who your friends and who the people that are close to you really are. So I'm really, yeah, thankful to my wife and to this friend of mine. His name is Hardik, for you know, going along with this madness.
So you're helping this guy with some sort of a business or something, aren't you? And what's your connection with him now beyond just being friends?
Basically, I'm trying to help him start his own little business because he enjoys traveling so much, and he's got such a talent for interacting with both foreign and local people. You know, sometimes there are people.
It's like a fixer.
Like a fixer, but I don't like that word so much because it sounds a little bit dodgy. So I'd say that he's also like a photographic assistant, translator, and a person to kind of lift up your spirits all in one, you know, because he knows,
okay.
He's learned a lot about photography. He picks things up very quickly. In fact, some people that I met online that I sent his way, he was showing them how to use a reflector. They just made a sort of a improvised reflector. And yeah, he's really with it. You know, he really has a good sense for adventure until he gets somewhere where it's too cold. Cause I guess he's from a relatively warm place. Yeah. Yeah, he's just that's probably the reason why I could get a lot of the shots that I got while I was traveling around Rajasthan and Gujarat, because of him. You know, you really have to. I don't speak Hindi. I don't speak Gujarati. So he was really my bridge between those cultures, which are so fascinating, but yet so incredibly different to my own. So, yeah, he was the catalyst behind a lot of those images. So I thought that. One day I told him, man, you know, you're just wasting your time working for call centers and doing that sort of stuff. Why don't you start up a little business? So that kind of business is not quite so easy to start, but he's kind of slowly working towards that. You know, a few people have gone his way. So if anybody needs a photographic assistant, a translator, and somebody to cheer you up, that's the person. to get in touch with, and if anyone isn't really interested in that, then they can just get in touch with me via my email on my website.
Okay, so that's the way they contact him would be through you. You're working as his manager, obviously.
if you can call it that, but there are some special people that have special talents, and is one of those people that should really, you know, you pull for some people, you want them to achieve something great in life, and he's one of those kinds of folks, and he's got a real talent for the stuff that I mentioned he can help with.
Yeah, you know what, I wish somebody would create and maybe it's out there, I just don't know about it, create a website that had and I'll just use the word fixer because photographers
sure.
know that word, but yeah. Like a fixer.com where people like him list themselves that are available in countries all over the world, because that would really be handy for people like us as we travel to different places, you know?
Yeah, I think, again, on one level it would be handy. On another level, you could get a whole lot of people that don't really have any clue going on there as well.
Wow.
So there's a danger in that as well. Perhaps they should have some kind of selection process or something along those lines in order to register.
Yeah, well, I mean,
interviews.
It's our site. We just started it, so you know we can do it.
That's it. Well, I do want to do it for some of my friends that I've traveled with, because again, it's no secret that some of those countries, the level of living is completely different to where, you know, most of the people listening to this podcast live, and it would be a really, really great help to some of these folks.
Well, sure. And you know, even like in Kashmir, in Srinagar, my friend Rashid
yeah.
Budiyari, he's such that there's a place where you need to be very careful where you go and how to read the signs. Like I lived there long enough to where I knew when they're starting to bring the shutters down mm-hmm. at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, mm-hmm. that means there's trouble in town.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But you or someone else may not know that that's what that means. And you walk right into some very dangerous situations there. And so that's where a local who knows the context of even more specifically than just someone for all of India, but in specifically for that region or that city even,
definitely
can be extremely helpful for people like us. So,
yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, that's good. All right. Well, hey, listen, Mitch, it's been great. I've wanted to do this for some time. I'm glad we finally connected. I'm looking forward to seeing more of your work online. Of course, people can find your work. Tell us again your website.
If you just go to mitchellkphotos.com, that's Mitchell with a double L, you can pretty much find everything else from there, the Twitter, the Facebook page. If you just remember that that site. That's okay. going to be enough.
They are amazing photos at that, and well worth your time to... I warn people, though, if you get there, you're going to start taking hours out of your day looking at all these images. They're wonderful. Plus, you have a really interesting blog, and so I'd advise people to drop by that blog, participate, read it. So thank you again for taking an hour or so out of your time to spend it with us. So, all right. Well, have a great day.
Thanks for having me, Matt. Thank you.
Depth of Field is made possible by the fine folks at Peach Pit Press, publishers of inspiration, creativity, and technique. With best-selling titles like Visual Poetry by Chris Orwig, Within the Frame by David Duchemin, and The Hot Shoe Diaries by Joe McNally, Peach Pit Press books and videos for today's photographers and Photoshop users.
This has been a Peach Pit TV podcast presentation. You can find more audio and video podcasts on iTunes or at peachpittv.com. Peach Pit TV, educating the world one podcast at a time.